This afternoon, our storytellers are Linda Nagy, who is the assistant professor and director of the Academic Support Center, Ann Hirschberger, professor of nursing, Jason Lukowitz, and I will stop to apologize on the misspelling of his name in the program. It is CZ, not TZ. Okay? We've had to do it enough in the department. We understand that. Lukowitz, Jason is the head coach for men's and women's cross country. If you really want to break it down, it's men's and women's indoor track, men's and women's outdoor track. Lynn Varink is assistant director of auxiliary services, and Dee Weichel, assistant professor of computer science. We will ask them to come to share their stories in that order, and then I will have a closing comment. Linda?
I wasn't planning to do this, but I don't relish this task, but as I look out at all of you, I value each of you as colleagues, and thank you for your commitment to EMU. One of my favorite authors is Kathleen Norris, and her short book, The Quotidian Mysteries, is one that I especially appreciate. Quotidian means occurring every day, commonplace, ordinary. In this book, based on a series of lectures in 1998, on spirituality, Norris describes a spiritual awakening in her life. While observing a Catholic Mass prior to becoming a woman of faith, she noticed the priest, in her words, doing a very menial task, washing dishes. He was actually cleaning the chalice that had been used to serve the blood of Christ to his congregation. In her text, Norris explores the value of tasks such as washing dishes, doing laundry, baking bread, walking and working outdoors. These menial, everyday tasks could lead to despair, but can also be the core of our salvation, the renewal of love of and in God, thus the mystery. The tasks that Norris mentions are tasks I love, and especially loved when I was a full-time homemaker and at-home mother of three for 13 years. Yes, I loved doing laundry. Nothing was more beautiful than a line full of clean white diapers. I likely still embarrass the neighborhood and Keith by hanging his underwear on our backyard line. It's there this morning, you can walk by. I also loved baking bread and anything that filled our kitchen with wonderful aroma from the oven. Cinnamon rolls with my mother-in-law bakery's recipe, homemade pizza, granola, and a dozen chicken casserole options. I began my cooking endeavors with More with Less cookbook, Oatmeal Bread, page 60, and expanded to creative recipes and menus, sometimes with mixed reviews. And then there was the daily opportunity to be outside, gardening, walking, hiking, biking, with children or Keith or by myself. I found joy and connection there with others and with God. Norris's book validated what felt right deep within my soul. My years at home were bookended by years teaching in the public school, 5 years before and 7 years after. The daily tasks were always there, but I was Mrs. Nagy with classroom responsibilities during the bulk of my day. I enjoyed those years, but state testing whittled the heart out of teaching, and I began to look around for another setting to put time and energy. I heard about an opening at EMU just 2 blocks from home, and fairly seamlessly began work there 14 years ago. I still live with Norris's Quotidian Mysteries. The geography has changed slightly, but I still do laundry, bake bread, and walk outside, at home and with 18-year-old college students. Yes, laundry. I advise pre-major students who sometimes come to EMU with a not-so-clean academic record. They need a fresh start and a little guidance along the way. Help choosing courses in which they can demonstrate their strengths, and examples of new ways of thinking and being in a setting with not typical American values. Sometimes the cleaning up comes after the students have been here a semester or two, when they need to think about and talk through former and newer study patterns and commitments. Sometimes they need a fresh vision, a new major, a new career path, a view of what a clean line of laundry looks like, figuratively, but maybe literally too. Then there's baking bread. You start with a recipe, right? Then you're creative. I've found that students sometimes need help with basic study skills, basic suggestions for how to manage time, read complex textbooks, complete assignments in stages, study for exams. Yes, each student will develop their own patterns that make sense for their own learning styles, but many need to figure out what those styles are and practice patterns that make sense for them. Sometimes they need help from someone to read and interpret the recipe. Someone such as Coach Link Coach Crystal, who walks with them to a professor's office, or Aaron, a tutor, and many other tutors we have, who help break down a major assignment into bite-sized pieces. There are opportunities for being creative. Perhaps they have a professor such as Mark Sowen or Judy Mullett, who allows an alternative assignment or exam that best demonstrates their concept their understanding of a concept. In the end, I get excited when a student claims empowerment to advocate for themselves, to create their own plan for their days and years ahead. But often a good recipe, the right tools, and a mentor chef are needed along the way. Lastly, walking in the great outdoors. I want students to find their joy at EMU, to find places and people that become a new home for them. I was so thankful for the first year writing focus on home for the past couple years. One of Vi Dutcher's assignments was to find and write about a place on campus where one feels at home. What fun to hear about the places on campus where students feel connected. The Hills Labyrinth, the Commons Basketball Court, the Science Center's Peace Garden. But it's not always easy to find such a place when a student is commuting to campus, living at home, and helping to care for their siblings, and sometimes their own child. I appreciate the attention EMU is paying to these students, commuter students, first-generation college students, multicultural students. Each group of students has unique challenges. My faculty homepage says that I thrive to make connections for myself and for my students, with other faculty and staff as they work with students, and between students' skill development and their academic goals. If every student with whom I work connects with at least one other student and one other faculty or staff during their first year, I feel that the year has been successful in at least one aspect of their time at EMU. Likewise, I value making my own connections with other faculty and staff and departments on campus. I love our little department, Marty, Joy, and me in the Academic Support Center, and thank you for sitting up here with me. But I find great energy and enthusiasm for the job when I can partner with the admissions, retention, undergraduate dean's office, counseling center, writing program, the many academic departments, and the list goes on. The mystery of the everyday, doing laundry, baking bread, walking outdoors. I pray that you will recognize and savor the holy in what can seem to be the mundane quotidian tasks of your daily work. I pray for joy and energy for the year ahead.
I don't know Lynn, Jason, or Dee very well, but Lynn and I have been friends and colleagues for many decades, and you need to understand the variety that there are among us. Yesterday I emailed Linda and said, "Arg, I'm having trouble getting this together." And she, in Linda fashion, said, "Oh, I did mine in June." That's who we all are. That's just it. When the thoughts came together for this, I realized that what came to me was not what I do right now, right here, even though that is the context and you are my people, particularly my department. But what came to me was what has shaped me and brought me to this place and what I have done in the last, I think I'm on year 28. I should have known that my life would not be my own. My mother knew because she prayed Hannah's prayer and gave me to God. She couldn't have known that another mother gave up Ann Wilson into the arms of God and the state of Ohio, hoping for a better life. So my life was not my own and is not my own. Service was a given in the Graber family where I was nurtured. I was nurtured tangibly through visit to migrant camps, rescue missions, harvesting with neighbors, MCC Christmas bundles, purchasing West Bank needlework, missionary visits, and continual hospitality. These activities were engaged in with joy. My room in the home was next to the tramp room in the farmhouse. Tramps were no longer common at that point, but the room stood testament to the way my grandparents and parents had lived. Tramps were always welcome. Leading, however, was discovered more through nature in those early years. I liked to make things happen. When I met my birth mother 10 years ago, I realized that the independence, feistiness, curiosity, too broad of interests, trust, and the joy came from both of us being probably an Enneagram number 7, the enthusiast. I never did seek formal positions of leadership, but I found myself saying yes most of the time. And that meant that I didn't mind being different, and I didn't mind being alone, because I usually was. Self-confidence, however, often erred toward arrogance. When the youth group vice president at church in high school told me I shouldn't be president, he should, because he's male and I'm female, I didn't get angry. I just said, Alan, they voted for me, not for you. Fortunately, these traits were corralled and nurtured and shaped through mentors here at EMU, both as a student and as a young faculty. Through the years, particularly in nursing, I've watched the views shift regarding service. In the 70s and 80s, service fell out of style because it was equated with servitude, or the nurse as a handmaiden to the male physician. I couldn't stomach that, so I simply chose to start my nursing in Nicaragua, where we worked independently as about 6 or 8 nurses with the community. And I realized there that I chose to serve. I choose to serve. I was not forced to serve. Service was my response to God's covenant with me. Along the way of these 60 years, I've made a few observations about how I combine service and leadership. Let me share a couple. I learned to act in the space I had. God put me there. God would provide what I needed. That gave me confidence with that clear potential for arrogance, as mentioned. When leading workshop for large groups in Nicaragua in the 1980s with the Nicaraguan Mennonite Church, a man came to me in clear angst. "Ay, Anita," he said. "My theology tells me that I shouldn't listen to you as a female in public space, but I'm learning so much." "Only do what you're comfortable doing," I replied. I was comfortable, but it was not the time or the place to get on a soapbox. He was hurting. Jim and I always assumed that we would spend much of our lives serving internationally in service, but we had to change course when it was clear that we needed to support our daughter who needed to learn to live with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So for the last several decades, my space has been reduced from what I thought it would be. Global service has been provided to me, opportunities have been provided to me through the cross-cultural program here and through board work with Mennonite Central Committee. That meant for MCC that I could act in that space and recently in the last years contribute to the monumental process of MCC restructuring. Second, I learned early on that I could both help in service and leadership, and I could hurt. First example is ducklings and piglets. I raised ducks for pocket money, and in the beginning, when they started pecking out of their shell, I would help them, and they always died. and I realized that that hurt. On the other hand, with my small hands and small arms, Dad would often call me when hogs were delivering, and if one was having trouble, I could go in after the piglets, and I saved many a piglet. And I realized that one needs discernment to know when to help or when one could hurt. I had to figure some of those things out, and I still am. As high school student council president, I finally called off our planned student sit-in when the school board agreed to discuss our hot topic issue, which was whether or not boys had to wear socks with sandals. And I was threatened with expulsion. That helped, too. But I did not, however, address the rampant alcohol abuse that was happening at our high school parties, hurting the chance to discuss a real issue that killed people. I learned to choose issues carefully. In Nicaragua, parents carried a 12-year-old girl down the mountain to the clinic, who we discovered was in critical condition due to anemia caused by hookworm. We hurried her to the bus to get her to the hospital, and the bus driver refused to take her. He said, "She'll die en route, and then what will I do?" We used our white North Americanness, insisted on getting her on that bus, and she died. I also discovered that I could use my North American whiteness to get people admitted to the hospital who truly needed it and didn't have any way to get there, and therefore many lives were saved. I learned to be aware of power. Third, I might need to act alone, but I'm never really alone. When I was a student here, I discovered a faculty who was lying to students and turning us against our nursing faculty. When I was finally convinced by Burl that I needed to go to the dean, I was too afraid to act alone because I couldn't face the wrath of my classmates right before graduation. I agreed to share, but only on the Friday night of graduation when they could not ostracize me. But I was wrong. I actually wasn't alone. Many would have stood with me. During my first term of service in Nicaragua, Nicaragua entered open war between the Somocistas, the dictator Somoza, and the rebel Sandinistas. At one point, after confrontations in Managua, we were all given the choice as to whether to go home or not. And that was an individual alone choice. I chose to stay because of a fledgling health promoter program that I was working in, but we had to support and let each other make their own decision. Later, near the end of the war, the board pulled us all out. Last week, I wondered if our son Nathan and wife Caitlin with MCC in Iraq will face the same choice. For me, serving and leading is in the context of one diverse worldwide church. Rowan Williams says, "We are not one because we've managed to find a more or less satisfactory level of agreement among ourselves, but because there is one invitation to one relationship with God the Father." This unity is always expressed in very diverse ways, he says. I have experienced this diverse oneness in issues, particularly across the conservative, progressive, theological continuum, the color and culture spectrum, and the range of poor to rich. I served with the Conservative Mennonite Conference, read the book that was just written among by faculty. I served the Conservative Mennonite Conference even though I was from a more progressive group. But alas, I ended up falling in love with Jim, whose parents, as beachy Amish, saw him as potentially losing his faith by working with this liberal conservative Mennonite conference. God has a sense of humor. And ironically, I found myself over the years continually trying to create a space for a theological range of Anabaptists. We need each other. About a decade ago, I insisted to MCCUS that we hold the CMC board position open and empty, even though they refused to appoint somebody. Eventually, someone came forward, and their presence has resulted in significant interactions and relationships that have benefited MCC. I long for that here. On the other hand, I am very uncomfortable about my uneasy acceptance of the lack of color diversity where I live and where I work. After years of focus on anti-racism in MCC, I believe I've neither served nor led in this way of being one church in other parts of my life. Culture has been easier than color. The church includes the poor. When Rita, later Anne, lived with us 7 months each after becoming homeless, we learned about trauma, mental illness, and our own assumptions. As Rita said to me one day, it's easy for you to say I should not have a cell phone because you don't have one. If your car died on the road, someone would stop and help you. Look at me, fat, toothless, and with a bad car. Who would stop and help me? And I was caught off guard. She was right. I need to be led by the poor in order to serve. I need to be in close relationship. My life flows on in endless song. It's not my own life. I am God's. The peace of Christ makes fresh my heart. Joy still gives energy. I still dream of making things happen. When no one is looking, I skip down the halls at the campus center. I cry when reading student papers, and I look for spirit stirrings every day. Since love is Lord of heaven and earth, how can I keep from singing?
I'm Jason Lukowitz. As mentioned before, I coach the track and cross-country team, and take no offense to the misspelling of the last name. I'm kind of used to it, and I always like to say, you can call me whatever you want as long as you don't call me late for supper. And those of you who are runners might be able to appreciate that even more so. But starting my fourth year here at EMU, and it's been a great experience, and I'll touch on that a little bit. And as I was kind of reflecting back, I was thinking to my first day or two when Dave King was shuffling me around campus, just meeting individuals, a number of you all, and I was immediately thrust into the Mennonite name game. And now, while my name meets the syllable criteria of that game, quickly found that the tree had no branches, so we kind of had to move on from that. But like I said, you guys have been welcoming, and it's been a great, rich time for me and my family. And like I said, I'll share a little bit about that. First, I want to talk a little bit just about my story, the chapters of my past, and then kind of focus at the end on the chapters that are to come. I'm a native of Shelby, North Carolina, which is a border town right on the South Carolina border. And while my accent may give away that I'm a Southerner, I am also an example and proof that looks can be deceiving. I'm the son of a Native American mother, Cherokee, and a European Jewish immigrant father. And so I had that dynamic going on. My mother actually left my life by the time I was five, and my father met and remarried, and I was adopted by a true Southern belle of a woman who I became my mother, and who I owe a huge debt of gratitude and much love to, and this accent as well. So, and my father, once again, he was an immigrant, came to America with my grandparents at a young age, the age of my children. My grandparents have a fascinating story, which we don't have time to get into too much, but they, as youngsters in France, as Jewish youngsters in France, got to have a firsthand account of Nazi occupation of France, the Holocaust, as many of their family members were sent to concentration camps or snuck off to join the French resistance, while they themselves were both hidden out in the French countryside for the duration of the war. Pretty fascinating. They met in Paris, as it can only be scripted in a movie, and immigrated to America, landing in Philadelphia, where my grandfather, taking his fifth grade education and a sewing machine, turned some menial labor jobs into a thriving textile industry that by the time I was born, he was in charge of. He retired early and tired of paying American taxes, moved back to France and set up shop there. And so my childhood, my summers between the ages of 8 and 16, while most of my friends were playing baseball or at the Boys and Girls Club, I spent mine at my grandparents' house right on the Mediterranean Sea, much of the time being bored and, yeah. And with nothing to do, and now as I reflect on that, I wish I could have those years back. Maybe now, make for a great vacation. But those were certainly good times that were rich, just getting to spend time with my grandparents who now live in Costa Rica. And so some may also be surprised to know that know me that I wasn't a product of a Christian home. Once again, my father was a secular Jew, and my mom grew up in faith, but I just kind of went along and was just kind of complicit in the spiritual apathy of our home. It was a good home, but that part wasn't there. But looking back, it's amazing to see how God in his grace and his providence systematically picked us off one by one, starting with my sister and her husband. I didn't sound very good, but it was a beautiful thing. It was a beautiful thing. So kind of worked its way through our family, and then by my sophomore year of college, coming home for Christmas break to hear from my father that he had given his life to Christ and has done great things and great work for the Lord since then. And so just kind of fast-forwarding to college, went to school and had a great experience in Appalachian State. It was 2 weeks before I started my student teaching when I met the fate of so many of our students today. I realized I don't want to be a teacher. And so so much to the chagrin of my parents. And so I persevered, finished my student teaching, and I did what any wise person, I guess, would do who didn't know what they wanted to do with their lives. I stayed in school, again, to the chagrin of my parents. But I'm glad that I did. I got a master's degree that I actually ended up using, and then I met my wife during that time, my beautiful wife, Wendy. And we've been married for 12 years, and if she knew the odyssey that we were going to be on before then, I'm not sure that would have happened, but in the 12 years that we've been married, we've called 4 places home, and so it's been quite the adventure. And in the midst of that, we've also had 4 boys, and all of them were born in different places, by the way. None of them share the same birthplace. I've held jobs that range from a residence hall director, being in charge of a building of 530 freshmen guys. Yes, you heard that correctly. And to going to a school to be the director of housing, then to find out on the first day that I was also getting put in charge of Greek life. That was exciting. Eventually, I found my way into coaching and realized that was a calling, and that led me to Missouri and then to EMU. And once again, it's been an exciting time. Thankful to many of you for just your support of our program as we've grown. As I came here, it was a program that just needed a breath of fresh air, and I saw the vision of what it could be and what this place could offer for our team. And it's been great working with my awesome staff as we've gone about the work of building up a program and seeing now a team that, you know, the first year we were literally going through the cafeteria trying to pull folks out for the team. And we're excited that we're going to be welcoming about 60 student athletes that will be part of our program this year in year 4. So that's exciting. Many of whom are in your classes and obviously and are a part of the campus in so many ways. So we're excited. This is the first year we are coming in with expectations, and some people aren't big on expectations. I like them because it shows that you're doing something right. I'm really proud of the student athletes on our team, and it's the heart of, you know, why I do what I do, just pouring into them and just seeing them grow. We have lots of young people with character and integrity, and we recruit that. Obviously, we look for talented individuals that can help us be successful, but we look for those intrinsic qualities that are going to make positive citizens, knowing that our role as coaches is to help build them up and send them out, along with what you all are doing as well. And so I feel good about the student athletes that we have on our team, and as they're growing and developing, and the growing pains, the role that I get to have with them. And so we go into this year, and we have big goals. We're looking at things like ODAC championships and school records and going to NCAAs. Those are tangible things now that we have the opportunity to do. And once again, just to invite you to continue to just support us. You have a couple chances in the fall to watch the cross-country team. A lot of times our teams kind of work in anonymity because we're running and doing all these things. People understand why we run as far as we run, and they don't get it. And you think cross-country meet would be like going to the dentist, but I assure you it actually can be a fun experience. So I encourage you to come out and check that out. So we have all these goals, and these things are coming to fruition, but what I wanted to kind of focus on during this next stretch is just the heart of why I do what I do and why I'm doing that here. And I made a decision when I came here, just as in my previous places of work, that I wanted to be about God's work and his business and using the platform that we have, the opportunity that I have to bring honor to him and to glorify him. So we're doing that through track and field, and we're doing that through cross country. And it's while I've been told it's risky, it's on the front lines of our conversations. It's in the first phone call that I make to a recruit, the first letter that goes out, the first time someone visits campus. We talk about a number of things, but it comes back to the heart of what we're doing, that God gets glory through what we're doing. How do we even do this? We talk about that with our team. Obviously, people come from different backgrounds, different traditions. What does it look like? What I found is that it looks differently to different people. And we talk about these things. One of the advantages, especially with the distance runners, is we go out on these 50, 60, 70-minute runs, and you'd be amazed at some of the conversations that happen. Now, I've told this before, and people have been mad at the fact that we have conversations while we're running. But it's a beautiful thing, and I've had some great opportunities just to interact with our students, talking about their faith journeys, learning their stories, and just sharing about the goodness of God and His plan for their lives and also for our team. And as I look ahead to the next chapter in my story and where we're heading this year, I have to also look inside. And how does this work with me? How does this apply to my life? So we talk about, you know, being able to control attitude and effort in a race and in your work, preparing for a race. That's really the only things that you have control over, your effort and then your attitude. And we talk about the phrase, what's your why? Why are you doing this? You know, there's so many things you could be doing with your time. You're here running, preparing for a race. What is your why? What's the point? You may be running for medals or for ribbons or for school records. Those records will be broken one day. Those medals will tarnish. The ribbons will get tattered. So what's really the motivation behind why you're doing this? So I have to ask myself the same thing. And as I've done that this summer, I've keep coming back to the words of Jesus in Matthew 28, as he gave out his great commission to his disciples, telling them to go and make disciples, and baptizing in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. And it's out of obedience to that that I think my next chapter and my goal is to do that, to go and to make disciples of my team. If you look at that passage, a lot of times it's attributed to missionaries overseas, and rightfully so. But if you break down the text, go therefore, the meaning of that means as you are going or as you are on your way. So that implies a calling to all believers that we're to make disciples, to make apprentices, if you will, for the kingdom. So that's what I want to do this year. That is my goal. And those of you who share in that passion know that this is hard, immersing work. It's not always easy. Sometimes it's painful, but it's necessary if we're to fulfill our jobs and our duty as educators. So my heart with my team and anyone really is just to share my story, to learn their story as well, just to talk about the amazing things that Jesus has done in my life, just to talk about how he has impacted, if he has impacted their story and their lives, and to see where those things may intersect. To talk about Jesus and all of his attributes, once again, being willing to be vulnerable. Talk about the Jesus who fed the hungry and healed the lepers, the same Jesus who flipped tables outside of the temple, the Jesus who said to love your neighbor as yourself, and also the same Jesus who said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one comes to the Father but by me. To wrestle with those things and to talk about those things. To share the good news of the gospel, God's great redemption plan, his rescue plan for us that was put into the place as soon as that apple was bitten. To talk about creation, fall, redemption, and restoration and what that means for us. And then allow room for the Holy Spirit to move while I move to deepening those relationships, meeting those students where they are, learning about their story, and through challenge and support, love and accountability, just furthering our relationship. And it's crazy to think this is through something as silly as running a race or preparing to run a race, we can do those things. And I feel blessed to be able to do that in my role here at EMU. So the next chapter, once again in conclusion, is to make disciples. And that's what I hope I'm able to do. I covered your prayers as I do that this year. And while we're over in athletics, if you're wondering what's going on over there, while we're preparing diligently to be ODAC champions and to do all those wonderful things that we train hard to do, it's my sincere heart that I can answer that call, and that my life and my leadership could be one of service and humility to my team and to you all as we work together to advance the cause of Christ here at EMU. I feel like there's no greater calling as educators. And as I close, this is my hope and my prayer that as we enhance the lives of our students through the knowledge gained in the classroom and through the other parts of campus, I hope that we can remain equally committed, if not more so, to seeing their hearts transformed through the love of Christ in the power of the gospel so they can be equipped to do the many wonderful things that they're being trained to do here with the perspective of the kingdom in mind. So I covet your prayers. I wish you blessings for a start of the new year. Thank you for your time.
Twyla, where are you? I apologize. I'm going to go over 10 minutes, okay? When Twyla asked me to do this and she told me what the theme of the faculty-staff conference was, it hit home for me. It was deeply personal. And for that reason, because I know I'm going to go over and because I tend to ramble if I talk off the cuff, if you would extend a little grace to me, I am going to read my story to you today. Serve and lead never really made sense to me until the fall of 2008. Prior to 2008, I would never have used the word serve and lead. Rather, I would have always thought of it as you serve or you lead. I never really looked at myself or anyone else for that matter as being able to do both of those things. After I graduated from college, I had trouble landing what I would term as a good job. Good being defined as well-respected, well-compensated, maybe supervisory in nature, and probably most importantly for a man in his early 20s, a job that people would look at me and say, that man's got it all together. He has some potential. He exhibits leadership. Instead, for the next 6 years, I worked a plethora of jobs that I would describe as not so well-respected, definitely not well-compensated, definitely not supervisory in nature, and most definitely not any that I would define as good jobs that offered leadership opportunity. In my opinion, I was doing a great job of serving, but I certainly wasn't doing much leading. In many ways, that damaged my self-perception because, you see, I thought it was one or the other. You serve or you lead. And I wanted to lead. In 2000, I began working as a program coordinator for the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. It was a great job. I oversaw educational programming for upwards of 20,000 visitors annually to the education center I worked at. I was well compensated. I supervised a pretty large staff. I got to rub shoulders with some important people. I was, in my mind, now leading and no longer just serving. Life was good. Then in 2007, in order to be closer to family, my wife and I moved to Harrisonburg in the Valley, and I needed a job, and I needed any job. It wasn't a month after moving that I ended up getting a job here at EMU working for physical plant, working on the grounds crew, pulling weeds, moving furniture, mowing grass, trimming trees. I'm not going to lie, it was somewhat of a struggle for me. It wasn't the work per se, I enjoyed that part of it, but rather it was how it made me feel about myself. I felt as though once again I was just serving and no longer leading. I was still living in that misguided mindset of I either serve or lead. I remember walking around campus at times feeling less than those around me. However, after a short 6 months at physical plant, I interviewed and was hired for the Assistant Director of Auxiliary Services, the position that I hold today. But a lot has happened between February of 2008, when I started that position, and now. As the Assistant Director, I was able to work alongside Matt Hunsberger and then Director Greg Becker, along with seven summer staff, to pull off what I thought, albeit my first summer, a fairly successful summer conference and event season here at EMU. I felt my work had value to the guests we served and to the university as a whole. I felt fairly well compensated, sort of. I got to supervise some staff again. I felt as though I was once again beginning to lead and not just serve. Yet I found myself at times still wishing for even more. Be careful what you wish for. At the end of that summer, Greg Becker, my director, left EMU. What to do now? Stay put and hope the director was someone I would work well with? Or interview for the director position and have what in my mind seemed to be that good job? I always thought I wanted to lead because of what it meant to me, But in my gut, I have always kind of known that I am more of a doer. Give me a job and I'll do it, and in most cases, I'll do it pretty darn well. Ironically, some of the responsibilities of being a leader have always been things that have created some anxiety for me, being a visionary, making big decisions. But I let pride overtake my common sense and my gut, and I interviewed, I was offered the job, and I accepted the job. So there I was, 6 months into the department, and I'm the director of the department. I was even better compensated, I was supervising people again, life was good. Or was it? We immediately started advertising for my assistant director position, and in the meantime, I was filling the responsibilities of both the director and the assistant director. It wasn't 1 month into the director position before I started waking up at like 4 a.m. in the morning. And then it was 3 a.m. And then it was 2 a.m., never being able to get back to sleep. I lost my appetite. I became distant and irritable at home with my wife and my daughters. I started developing a major lack of focus and feelings of being overwhelmed. And at the same time, my dad, 1,400 miles away in South Dakota, was in the late stages of Alzheimer's and had recently gone from living at home with my mom to a nursing home and then eventually into the hospital where he was refusing food and water because he no longer wanted to live. But everybody has difficulty in life, right? I mean, wasn't I still where I thought I wanted to be professionally? So why the symptoms that I was experiencing? I knew what was happening, but I didn't want to admit it. You see, I have always struggled with situational anxiety and depression. And here were a couple major life events that were throwing me for a complete loop. I immediately went to see my doctor and got on some new meds thinking I could get ahead of this thing. However, each day only got worse, not because of any pressure that was put on me by anyone else, but rather because of the pressure I was putting on myself to lead, or more importantly, the pressure of trying to be someone who I knew I wasn't. Things quickly deteriorated. I didn't sleep at all. I dreaded coming to work. When I was at work, I couldn't do the simplest of tasks because my mind was in a fog and I felt like a complete and utter failure. Here I was with that good job, with my opportunity to lead, and I couldn't even function. I was so pissed off at myself for having let my pride and my desire to lead and my desire to be someone I wasn't get in the way of my gut and my common sense. But here I was. I had made my bed, and there was no way out of it now. However, as the days slowly went by, I became increasingly hopeless. I did begin to see a way out. On the morning of September 19, I came into work and needed to submit my online credit card statement. I couldn't do it. I literally could not figure out how to do it, although I had done it many times before. In my eyes, I was a failure. I had completely hit bottom, and I saw no way out. And at that moment, I knew that the only way out of this hopeless situation was to make the most rational, irrational decision that a person can ever make. I called my wife to say goodbye, and she immediately knew why I was calling and what I intended to do. She pleaded with me to just stop for a second and to call Ron Piper, my then supervisor, until she could get there. For whatever reason, and by the grace of God, I did so. Ron came down and found me at my desk, shaking, sobbing, and having a complete anxiety attack. Ron immediately called Ken L. Nafsinger down from his office to offer his assistance. A little sidebar here. In typical Ken fashion, there's a really funny story that goes with that. And if you want to know, I will tell you after, but I don't have time to go into it now. To make a long story short, I ended up at RMH that morning. I met with a psychiatrist and was immediately admitted to the behavioral health unit. Reality hits home when a nurse takes away your shoestrings, your belt, and anything else that could be used to harm yourself. To summarize, I spent hours that week either in therapy sessions or with the doctors trying to fight a med regimen that would help me. But more than anything, I spent time alone in my room thinking, writing, praying, and trying to figure out what my purpose was in life. This whole idea of serving and leading was actually one that I had been mulling around in my head that week while I was in the hospital. I would ask myself, God, am I not cut out to lead? God, am I only capable of serving? God spoke to me that day in that third floor room, and I came to the realization that I didn't have to be an either-or thing. God told me that I could do both. He didn't tell me exactly how, but he told me that I could, and it would be my job to figure that out as I continued on my life's journey. On that same morning of September 19 that ended me up in the hospital, the next thing I was planning to do after filling out that credit card statement that I couldn't do was to drop in the mail an offer letter to the person that we had decided to hire as my assistant director. That letter never got mailed. As a result, after a few days in the hospital and after some discussion, Ron Piper and Marcia Engel very graciously offered me back my old position of assistant director if I felt in hindsight that it would be a better fit for me and keep me at EMU. I graciously accepted their offer, and 2 days later I was discharged and sent home with instructions to enroll in the week-long day program before I even considered coming back to work. Less than 24 hours after returning home, I received a phone call that my dad had died. I was still a mess. And as we flew to South Dakota on the plane ride out there, I remember thinking about this same question that God had been posing to me. How can I lead and serve? I couldn't figure out the answer. I was so frustrated. But I know now that I was thinking about it in the wrong context. Once I was on the ground in South Dakota and I was able to hug my mom and my siblings and we began talking about the funeral arrangements for my dad, it was then that God began speaking to me and opening doors into showing me how I could serve and lead. The pastor wanted someone in the family to share memories about my dad at his funeral service. My two sisters said they couldn't do it. All they would end up doing is crying the whole time. My three brothers said they couldn't do it. They were just dumb farmers and couldn't speak in public. Their words, not mine. So there I was, the guy that just got out of the mental health unit and not anywhere close to being healthy. And they were all looking at me to write something up and share it with our family and our community at my dad's funeral. I didn't want to do it. But I felt God nudging me, saying, embrace this opportunity to lead on behalf of your siblings and your mom. Embrace this opportunity to serve on behalf of your dad and his legacy. I did it, and it was the most rewarding thing I've ever done. And when I was finished, I had a complete new understanding of serving and leading. I came to the realization that you can serve and lead at the same time, and even more so that serving and leading encompasses all of life, not just your workplace or your vocation. After my dad's funeral, I returned home, finished the RMH week-long day program, and I slowly, in small steps, began coming back to work, but I came back different. My attitude had changed and my outlook on my work and my life in general began moving in a more positive direction. Each day I was no longer looking at the aspects of my life as an opportunity to serve or lead, but rather an opportunity to serve and lead, depending on the given situation and what was needed in that situation. Now, when I set up chairs at a rental event or play Barbies for the 1,000th time with my daughters, or clean up puke at the finish line of an indoor track meet, or help a neighbor with a project, or simply fold a blanket just perfect, nice, and square so it looks inviting to a guest in our summer dorm rooms. All those things make me feel good because I know that I'm serving. On the flip side, when I give guidance to a rental client on how to best coordinate their event, or if I train our work-study students for the summer conference and events chaos, or if I serve as the elder or chair of elders at my church, or provide counsel to one of my freshman transition students when I can see it in their eyes and their body language that they are in the same place I was in the fall of 2008. All of those things make me feel good too, because I'm leading. I often hear people say that sometimes we are on the mountaintop and other times we are in the valleys, and they tend to insinuate that things will only get better when we are back on the mountaintop. I don't necessarily agree with that. Because if you look at nature and you get high enough up on a mountain, what do you find? You hit the tree line where things stop growing and things become sterile. However, it's down there in the bottom of the valleys that the soil is the most fertile and where lush growth is experienced. I didn't enjoy my valley, but I'm forever grateful for all the valleys because of the growth that I experience in them. Do I still struggle with this idea of serve and lead? Absolutely. Sometimes because I don't want to serve and I want to lead. Other times because I don't want to lead and I want to serve. The beautiful thing is now I know that I don't have to do one or the other, I can do both. And I can do them knowing that regardless of what it is I'm doing, it is not a reflection of who I am or who I am not, but rather a reflection of what God has called me to do with the gifts that he has given me. Sometimes he wants me to lead and sometimes he wants me to serve. God does not call the qualified. He qualifies the called. It is really about the simplicity of being God's child, and it is sufficient to just be who we are, because the bottom line is that we are simply his. I'd like to conclude with the words of Philippians 4, 12 through 13. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. Thank you.
Wow, I have to say, those are some hard acts to follow. My name is Dee Weichel, and I've been here about 4 years. I get to get into my eccentric professor tilted glasses look now. So I'm a computer science professor, which will become obvious as you hear my story. Storytelling, in many ways, I find it somewhat surprising that I'm being asked to do this in a professional manner. It's a long family habit. Well, actually, I come from a long line of storytellers that some might call tall tale tellers. So I'll try today to kind of embrace that storytelling thing without getting too much into the tall tale part. So to keep track of my story, especially since I'm last, I'll give you three hooks. Sesame Street, community, and puzzle pieces. So first, Sesame Street, right? Sesame Street. When asked to do this, I wondered how in some quick way, it is 10 minutes, remember, I could describe my life. I have to admit that I often think of my life as a series of Sesame Street moments. Remember that part of Sesame Street where they show you four items, something like a banana, an orange, an apple, and a piece of cheese? Then they sing that song that goes something like this. One of these things is not like the others. One of these things just doesn't belong. Well, that is a bit like my life. I have always felt I am the cheese, the thing that's not like the others, the thing that just doesn't quite fit in. I am Presbyterian, you know. The frozen chosen, we embrace it. So, now, if you laugh too much, it will take more than 10 minutes of time. So I was born the daughter of a rodeo cowboy and his high school sweetheart in Casper, Wyoming in 1963. Yes, see, I'm really different. I don't mind saying how old I am. I'm 51. The alternative is not so good. My parents were very young when I was born. I was very influential in the timing of their marriage. And we often used to joke. I'm important. So we always used to joke the three of us grew up together. My dad went to college on a rodeo scholarship, and my mother worked as a secretary, later becoming an accountant. They didn't know they were supposed to get divorced, and we were all supposed to be totally screwed up. They just went on with their lives. After my dad finished college and I was 7, we moved to Orem. Orem is about halfway between Flagstaff and Phoenix, Arizona, and is a private college prep school in the middle of a working cattle ranch. Kind of unique. My father got a job there because not only could he teach both math and science, he was a smart rodeo cowboy, but was very qualified for the position of director of horsemanship. I was into the horse culture and even managed to win the title of rodeo princess. Thank you very much. 1 year. Okay. You don't know this, but actually table manners are a part of that competition. That probably put me a little ahead. But I was also an intellectual. In the summer, when other kids were running around the ranch, playing practical jokes and watching Gilligan's Island in black and white, there was no color TV on the ranch, and there was a lot of static. I could be found in the school library, pressed underneath a second-story study carrel, where I could see the desert vistas outside the gigantic wall of windows as I read. If you look at a map, there's not really anything of note between Flagstaff and Phoenix. We were in the middle of nowhere. I was a somewhat bizarre cross between a tomboy who refused to wear dresses, climbed trees, and took all of her Barbie dolls skydiving. Don't worry, all were fully equipped with full parachutes. Okay. And a nerdy intellectual. I tried to explain this to a computer science professor I had once who said, girls always want to dress up their Barbie dolls, and so we have video games for that. I said, no, mine always wanted to fly, I promise. I spent hours off in the desert alone on my horse. At that time, God was a constant companion, somehow always present in those amazing blue skies and big open country. I had very few limits on where I could ride my horse, and my favorite place was the top of the mesa that held the airstrip. The clouds would form massive arches that led to a cloud fairyland and opened up on level with the mesa top. I would gallop my horse across the long, flat airstrip and pretend I was riding out into heaven. So I was a bit odd on the ranch, but it was nothing compared to when we moved to the city of Phoenix. There I was, a hick from nowhere and deathly afraid to cross the street. Okay, there were cars. But also voted the most scholarly in my high school. I was the editor of the school literary magazine and wrote poetry. All that reading had paid off. I had that teenage confidence about what I was going to do and be. I was good at math, too. Initially, I thought I would be a teacher, but was encouraged to do something with my math ability. I decided I would be a computer scientist. An incident in my senior social studies class illustrates another way I was different. Our teacher, who was presenting an economics lesson, asked who would be a garbage collector if garbage collectors made $200,000 an hour. Basically, she was trying to show the power of money in an economic situation. A job that would normally not have any appeal would suddenly be the thing that everyone wanted to do. Everyone else cooperated and immediately raised their hand. Dee, wouldn't you be a garbage collector? No, I don't want to be a garbage collector. And there seems to be plenty of people willing to do that. My service was not required. But think of all the money she coaxed. No, I'm going to be a computer scientist, and they make enough money for me to be happy, I explained. This backwards logic broke all the rules and ruined the point she was trying to make. It took most of the rest of the hour to convince me that I would be a garbage collector for a short period of time to raise money so that I could go to college and be a computer scientist and be happy. So how, you might ask, would a teenager be thinking about what would really make her happy? Well, part of my response was simply teenage ego. I'm going to do what I'm going to do, not what you want me to do. Another part was my upbringing, my church experience, and my experience with community at Orem. At Orem, I'd met rich people, some students. Mary Tyler Moore's son went to camp there. Dick Van Dyke's daughter babysat me. And poor people, other students and immigrants that worked the ranch. It didn't matter how much money one had. Everyone did chores and contributed to the community. Service was valuable and indeed critical to the success of the community. I see servant leadership as leading by example, leading with the interest of the community in mind. We've heard this a lot today, and it resonates with me. This is the kind of leadership that I see exemplified by Jesus. Jesus wasn't afraid to be different, and he accepted those who were different. I identify with that. Although I don't think of myself as being a wonderful leader. I think I was shown this kind of leadership, though, in my teachers, youth group leaders, and my parents. My parents demonstrated that money is not what made them happy, and neither was success as defined by society. Our family being together and laughing, telling stories, and loving each other is what makes us happy even still. I went to college, necessary for this job, I suppose. Most of my roommates started out as engineers, or then I was a computer engineer, too. But out of the seven of us that began as roommates and friends, I was the only one who stayed in engineering. Stubborn cheese still. After college, I worked for about 8 years as an engineer. And I can tell you I appreciate so much all of you putting up with the harassment training, because as a female engineer, I've experienced that all firsthand, and I really appreciate the sensitivity that the training showed today. After college, I worked these two jobs. Then I got married and went back to graduate school while I had my kids. Talk about a lesson in servant leadership. Being a mother, while incredibly rewarding, has been one of the most isolating endeavors of my life. This is a time when I came to understand more fully the Bible verse, "To find yourself, you must first lose yourself." I indeed lost myself for several years, hardly sleeping, constantly working to take care of our children and to finish my degree. Finishing was not just my accomplishment. Rather, it was something that happened with the support of my whole family. My kids and parents were there when I graduated, clapping for mommy in the background as my husband, by then a UVA professor, hooded me. My advisor was not able to be there. He was not my advisor. And for that, I am a bit grateful. It seemed right somehow that my partner at home, who helped and enabled me, was able to share completely in that small moment of triumph. While indeed a moment of triumph, after graduating, I was again a bit lost. UVA was not a good fit, though the community of my home in Crozet was and is. I began to look around for opportunities, drawing an hour circle from our house and filling out applications. My husband insisted in church one day, oddly in church, that I apply to EMU. Looking back, it feels that God pulled me up by the hair and planted me at EMU. Instead of a series of Sesame Street moments, my life in retrospect is a series of specially crafted experiences to form me into what I needed to be here now. My undergraduate engineering degree, my PhD in computer science, and all the extra math courses I took along the way trying to be a mathematician are a perfect fit for our mathematical sciences department. In addition, the community I was a part of at ORM, the church of my youth, my current church, Westminster Presbyterian in Charlottesville, and my family have honed me into a rather unique puzzle piece. Through God's grace, most of my funny points and quirky edges have found a home here at EMU. After all, how many computer scientists besides Charles and me do you know that believe in God? It's a professional hazard, I think. Through looking with God's eye and the example of Jesus, the banana, the orange, the apple, and the cheese of Sesame Street can be seen as a banquet, and their differences are complementary. Like puzzle pieces, they fit together not because they are all the same, but rather because they are different. I am grateful to have found the community here at EMU. I believe that it has much to give the larger global community, especially in technology. In particular, the traditions of examining the use of tools, of listening to each other, caring deeply for one another, and living simply are wonderful examples for today's world. Leading in a global context, leading as Jesus led, is an extra challenge. For many of us, and here in this community, that challenge may be to go beyond serving others and living insular in our community, to accepting and loving the different other, the one thing that's not like the others, because in fact we all are not like each other. We are all puzzle pieces, and we can look past these differences that make us each into a unique puzzle piece and see instead how we all, every single one of us, fit into God's bigger picture. Thank you all very much.
Eastern Mennonite University, like no other. The richness that is here, I want to thank each of you for your vulnerability, for your openness. And if I heard this morning, leadership is relational. You've certainly gotten us started on that in a very special way, and thank you very much for that. And there's more of those around. Share them with each other throughout the year.